Chapter 19. Zeost. This set of ruins was no heap of rubble, which was good, since Ben wasn't sure he could reach the next place on the map. He had been 3 days without food. Kiara won. Shaker was down to draining energy from the various batteries Ben had brought from Faskus's camp. Of them, he retained only a partial charge in the primary blaster pistol. The data pads didn't count. Their batteries didn't contain enough energy to permit an R2 unit to walk 4 steps. But this set of ruins, it clustered high on a mountain ridge, built just below a cliffside hundreds of meters tall. The cliff looked like a portion of the mountain had been sliced away by a giant lightsaber millions of years in the past, leaving the stone to weather until some species decided to build a citadel here. Not some species. The original Sith species. The citadel was made of black and mottled gray stone, and looked large enough to house 1,000 people. But no one lived there now, Ben thought. Not that he could be sure. He detected little flickers of life through the Force, but those impressions were always washed away by the flow of dark side energy that emanated from the place. Like the planet itself, the citadel was suffused in such energy, but more so. Still, the voices were pleased that he was here. He heard them even when he was awake now, and when he dreamed, they taught him how to fly the eye-shaped craft they had shown him. Desire, focused the right way, would cause the craft to lift off, to fly. Anger would direct its weaponry. Weapons he didn't understand and could not quite visualize. And he could reach out through it, make contact with his ships, direct them on their missions of...
Ben! Ben!
He was tired of the voices, and didn't know why they even bothered to speak his name, since they had his attention all the time now. Then he realized it wasn't the voices. It was Kiara. He looked down at her and frowned. What? She took an involuntary step away.
You're that way again.
What way?
Scary.
He considered his answer. I have to be this way sometimes. It's how I'm learning. He imagined Jason saying it to him, back when he was just learning the ways of the Force, back when the Force had frightened him. Wait a minute. How can she tell? And what is she feeling? He tried to clear his thoughts, something that he hadn't really been able to do well since he had gotten hungry and stayed that way. Because she walked behind him, she had to be sensing something in the change of his body language. Either that, or she was sensing something through the Force. Perhaps she was Force-sensitive. And if that was the case, then she was probably being spooked by manifestations of the dark side. In him. Again, he shoved away notions of dark side and light side. It was all in what one did with the power. And yet, since he'd been here, he'd been surrounded by an insinuating malevolence that didn't come from anything alive. It was energy that had been shaped and left here by hundreds of generations of Sith and followers. And if the energy had definite shape, even when not being generated by the living, was that not the dark side? He took a deep breath and tried to push the voices away, to cleanse his thoughts. Gradually he did so, and felt a lightening of spirit. Silence came to his ears, broken only by the occasional rustle of wind through the dead branches behind them, by Kiara's breathing, by the tiny whine of servos within Shaker. Finally, he looked at Kiara again. Better? She nodded, pleased.
Better.
Coruscant, Senate Building, Admiral Neothel's office. Neothel answered the beep with a gravelly command.
Come in!
Jason Solo entered, dressed in his immaculate black guard uniform and a flowing black cloak. He gave her a crisp salute. "Admiral." Neothel returned it.
"Sit. Hurry. I have a meeting in 30 minutes."
Jason sat. "Galadder."
"I don't understand."
"Probably because I hurried. Galadder 8 is where the Confederation meeting is going to take place. The election of your counterpart, their supreme military commander, and the launch point of their next fleet action." Neothel sat up straighter.
"Intelligence has been working on this all this time, and you come up with an answer first?"
"I have sources distinct from intelligences."
"Such as your parents?"
Neothel didn't miss the slight frown that crossed Jason's features. "My parents had nothing to do with obtaining this information. It's from another smuggling resource I've been cultivating for months."
"Interesting. Especially in light of the fact that intelligence has offered independent verification of the information about the election being followed by a raid. A shipyard raid."
Jason nodded. "That's what my source says, too."
"Promising. When?"
2 weeks. Actually, 13 standard days, nearly exactly." Neothel made an exasperated noise.
"It will take that long at least to put together a coordinated response. We are going to rush into our counterplan and get good people killed as a consequence."
"If I may." Jason drew a data card from a pocket and set it on the desk before Neothel. "I've taken the liberty of putting together a proposal. For a response you would probably consider uncoordinated, but it would get forces there fast and possibly undetected. And I doubt our equally uncoordinated enemy will anticipate it." Neothel gave him a dubious look and inserted the card in her desk slot. Jason's plan was simple and unconventional. Galadder was an undistinguished mid-rim star not far from Ancion. Not one of its worlds was habitable for most of the galaxy's sapient species. The planet Galadder 8 was a gas giant, a world whose surface was a beautiful, glowing swirl of mottled reds, oranges, and yellows. At one point in the distant past, it had been a favorite vacation spot for the Old Republic, circled by a ring of resort satellites, from which patrons could marvel at its natural beauty. But tastes changed, and the brief era in which planetary artistic appreciation could serve as the be-all and end-all of a wealthy family's vacation ended, and with it the years of usefulness of the Galadder system. The last resort satellite had gone out of business a century and a half ago, and Jason's estimation was that the resort would probably be the site of the meeting to come. Step one of his plan was to send Jedi-piloted Stealth-X snub fighters into the system, giving the Alliance military information about the Confederation forces already there, particularly sensor platforms. Step two involved bringing in forces selected from fleets and task forces already in that area of the galaxy, choosing them carefully to keep any one unit from losing too much strength and defeating the ability of spies and analysts to determine where those reassigned craft were going. Step three had the Jedi observers directing Alliance forces into the system, avoiding sensor observation or scouting patrols, and setting them up within the atmosphere of Galadder 8. The glowing, radiant atmosphere was so thin at its upper reaches, barely denser than empty space in a standard solar system, that vehicles and vessels of all varieties could be stationed there. Such a world tended to emit higher levels of electromagnetic radiation, making communication between vehicles more difficult, but also making detection more difficult. Step three would continue until the mission commander concluded that it was no longer possible to sneak forces into the atmosphere of Galadder 8. And even then, larger capital ships could muster at a point outside the system and be ready to jump in. In step four, the StealthX observers would signal when the meeting had begun, and all the Alliance forces would move in against the Confederation forces. Neathel and her analysts evaluated Jason's plan, and over the span of a day, considered and discarded several others. Eventually, they settled on Jason's. It would have to be modified and detailed, but it would serve as a template. At their next meeting, Neathel informed Jason of her decision, and said,
"I will lead this mission myself."
He nodded, apparently pleased. "I also want to be there."
"With the Anakin Solo?"
"Yes."
"Good. Consider it authorized."
"My opinion doesn't count much with my uncle these days," Jason admitted. "To get Jedi involvement, you probably ought not to mention my role in this."
"I'll have Jedi involvement. All it takes is issuing an order."
Jason smiled. "I meant to get wholehearted Jedi involvement."
"Yes, of course."
As he emerged from the Senate building, Jason felt a familiar presence. He did not react visibly, as the tall woman wrapped in anonymous garments, her lower face shrouded by a scarf, fell into step beside him. "How are you?" he asked.
"Well,"
Lumia answered.
"Fully healed."
"Interested in going on an expedition?"
"I sensed that you were moving into a troubled period, into much danger. That's why I came."
"I'll take that as a yes." Jason changed the subject. "Any news of Ben?"
"No. His monitors have temporarily lost track of him."
A note of worry entered her voice.
"He may not have survived."
"I think I would have felt it if he had died."
"Perhaps not. Where he is?"
Jason didn't ask. "I have faith in him."
"Clearly so,"
she said. Zeost. The last kilometer of the climb up to the Citadel was comparatively easy. The roadway, made of dressed black stone slabs that were cracked here and there, but otherwise seemed little worn by the passage of time, wheels, or feet, allowed Shaker comparatively quick passage. But the little droid began to slow again, 200 meters from the tumble of rock that apparently marked the Citadel's main entrance, and came to a complete stop 100 meters from it. Ben felt like stopping, too. He shook from cold and hunger. He returned slowly to Shaker's side, noting that the droid's lights were still functioning. He pulled out his datapad. "What's wrong, little guy?" "I lack sufficient power to move farther." Ben thought about sighing, but didn't want to expend the energy. Shaker was running on a charge absorbed from the last blaster's power pack. If Ben wanted to give the droid more time, he'd have to sacrifice the power pack from his lightsaber. "How long can you stay awake on the charge you have if you don't move?" "Perhaps 12 hours. "All right. Shut down now. I'll wake you up when I've found a power source." The droid gave an obliging beep sequence, and its lights went off. Ben turned back toward Kiara, swaying from sudden dizziness. And the gray-furred neck leapt at him. The rampway leading to the Citadel was raised, and the creature must have been paralleling their path from just past the drop-off. Ben's reflexes, dulled by lack of food and sleep, would have let him down, would have allowed him to become the next meal, but he wasn't standing in the open. He pushed away from Shaker, staggering back into Kiara and tripping over her. And the neck missed. It landed gracefully and turned. Ben rose on shaky legs and ignited his lightsaber. The neck regarded him, head down, obviously considering whether to attack, then charged away, disappearing over the far lip of the walkway.
"They're going to eat us,"
Kiara said. Ben switched off his lightsaber. "No, they're not."
"I'm not scared anymore."
It was clear to him that she was, but he knew she had said it to reassure him that it wouldn't be so bad, that he wouldn't be failing her. "If one swallows you, I'll jump down his throat and we'll cut our way out together," he promised her.
"What if it chews?"
This time he did sigh. "You're too logical." It took them the better part of 4 hours to climb to the top of the rubble heap that blocked the main entrance into the citadel. From the top, Ben could see the trench-like gap between portions of outer wall that had not fallen, and the high, more intact inner wall of the citadel itself. He could see gray-blue skies and white-capped forests stretching to the horizon. It was all so beautiful that he wanted to stay forever. And it occurred to him that if he killed and ate the little girl, he'd recover his strength swiftly. Maybe he'd even cook her first. But she was looking at him when the thought came, and the way she slowly drew away from him reminded him that the thought was not his own. He forced it away and gave her a little smile, a genuine Ben smile. The stone doors beyond the rock pile were down, and it took far less time to descend into the outermost great chamber of the citadel. The only lights available to him were little streaks of sunlight entering by windows near the ceiling. They let him see that there were no furnishings left in this chamber, not even moldy, tattered remnants. It had been stripped of goods long ago. All that remained were entryways into black hallways and curved stone staircases going up or down. He desperately wanted to descend. He knew the eyeball-shaped ship was somewhere below, hidden, waiting for him, calling to him. But he had no strength, and he knew that if he were to become the ship's master, he would have to conquer it. "We'll camp here," he told Kiara. She looked around dubiously, but said nothing. Ben slept, and dreamed that in the darkest hour of the night something detached itself from the ceiling far above. It looked like three giant balls, the center one slightly larger and attached to the other two by pivots. A cluster of five legs emerged from each end ball, and they worked together to allow the thing to walk slowly down the wall. In his dream, he said, "Go away."
"No. This is my home now. Your kind is gone. I shall eat you."
"I'll kill you."
It paused halfway down the wall.
"Give me the little piece of meat. I will leave you alone."
"I'll kill you."
It began its descent again.
"Outside," Ben said, "there are necks, hunting me. I couldn't bring myself to eat the first one. Now I wish I had. But you can. Go outside and hunt the necks. They'll be close."
The thing stopped again and waited a full minute. Then it changed course, moving toward the top of the rock pile. Rocks tumbled down the pile as it squeezed through the opening. In his dream, Ben thought he heard necks howling.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
The voices faded as Ben awoke. Hurriedly, he glanced around. Kiara, looking pale, her features sharpening from strain and starvation, was still asleep next to him. The ceiling was better illuminated. Around its edges there were many odd shapes, curved balconies, broken statuary, other forms he couldn't identify. He wondered if any of them might become the thing he had seen in his dream. He prodded Kiara awake. "Come on, we have work to do."
"Are we going to wake Shaker up?"
"I hope so." As his last act of preparation, Ben reconnected the tracer's severed antenna leg to its main body, then hung the pouch loop around the dummy he'd constructed. It wasn't much of a dummy, just a carefully built pile of stone with red blankets draped around it. But perhaps it would do. It was situated at a spot where the outer walls still stood, and the base of the inner wall was littered with stones that had fallen from the high reaches. The pouch hung from its neck. Kiara following, Ben retreated past the shriveled, frozen neck body they had discovered upon emerging that morning. They found a spot concealed between two courses of dressed stone, and they waited. Ben was as alert as his starvation-induced lack of focus would allow him to be. Time passed. In the stillness, Ben began to hear the voices again.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
"You used to want me to protect her."
Ben had thought his words inaudible, but Kiara spoke up.
"Who are you talking to?"
"No one."
"Eat, girl."
Why were the voices different now? That was a puzzle, and Jason had always said that puzzles should always be solved, because then they became information that could be used. He tried to look at the voice's suggestion rationally. It made sense on a purely logical level. If he killed, cooked, and ate Kiara, he would have several days' worth of food. His mind tried to veer away from that line of thought. Cannibalism had almost always been discussed in his presence in cautionary tales of stranded crash survivors and people driven mad. But he forced himself to consider the matter.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
If he did kill and eat her, he'd never be caught, never be punished. Even if he confessed to Jason, his mentor would analyze the data and determine that it was the correct survival choice. In fact, just about every logical argument Ben could come up with suggested that eating Kiara was the most appropriate action. The plan Ben had just set into motion might not work. It might take days to complete. He could be dead before then. Every logical argument. Ben frowned. But not all arguments had to be logical. Kiara was a little girl, and one who had just lost her father. Her daddy. Never mind that her daddy seemed to have been a small-time criminal, and the odds, supported by files of data Ben had seen on the guard computers, were that Kiara would grow up to be a small-time criminal, or another type of drain on society. She might grow up to invent a medicine better than Bacta, or to write songs, or act in holodramas that made things better for people. Or she might have children who did these things, or teach children to do these things. But not if she died now. He wasn't even sure he liked her. They hadn't had energy enough to talk very often on their long walk. But he felt bad for her. He felt protective of her. He felt. And it seemed to him that neither thinking nor feeling needed to be the boss of the other. In a Jedi, they should be mixed. Partners. He wondered if that was the case with guards as well. None of that answered the question of why the voices had started by suggesting that he protect Kiara, and now insisted that he eat her. But the answer, a possible answer anyway, came to him. They had told him to protect her because that's what he had decided to do. And he hadn't known how. In suggesting that they could get Ben and Kiara off this planet alive, They had made Ben listen to them. He had begun to understand them, and then had begun to think the way they thought. And now they could suggest different things. They could suggest what they'd wanted all along. He felt a burst of anger, but clamped down on it. He didn't have the energy to be angry right now. He noticed that the voices had grown quiet. And in that quietness, Ben told Kiara the story of a young force-sensitive slave boy who won a pod race on Tatooine and earned his freedom.
"Did they feed him when he won?"
Kiara asked. "All he could eat. And even more," Ben assured her. Not long afterward, Ben sensed the eye in the sky. He looked up into the clouds and pulled his all-weather cloak even tighter around them.
"Is he there?"
"Yes, he is." This pilot was not subtle. He sent the TIE fighter into a screaming dive that ended up with the vehicle a mere 20 meters above the ground. Then he had to slow and circle, because Ben's dummy was not visible from the open spaces around the Citadel. He had to climb and then drop into the gap between outer and inner wall. And then he lined his lasers up on Ben's dummy.
"Now!"
Through the Force, Ben exerted himself against the stones at the top of the inner wall, all along the course of wall above the starfighter. It was hard going. He felt so tired, and it was almost impossible to focus. But an understanding that this might be the difference between life and death, from cold or starvation or mummification, drove him, and he saw the stones high above begin to rock and then fall free. The TIE fighter fired, and Ben's dummy fell over, the blankets catching on fire. The TIE fighter glided forward slowly on repulsors. Ben knew why. The bolt from a laser cannon hitting a human being wouldn't necessarily destroy his body completely, but it would turn so much of the body to steam that the victim would seem to explode. It wouldn't simply fall over. The pilot had to be curious about what had just happened. The TIE fighter was a mere 5 meters from the burning dummy when the first stone, no larger than a human head, hit its hull. To his credit, the pilot reacted instantly, veering away and climbing, straight into the thickest portion of falling stone. The rocks had fallen more than 100 meters. Some weighed a quarter ton or more. All had sharp, right-angled edges, and some of them hit edge first. The TIE fighter spun wildly out of control, hit the Citadel's inner wall, and bounced off again. The twin ion engines were still firing, but the starfighter was spinning so fast that they merely added to the energy of its spiral. It landed beyond the outer wall, its hull collapsing on impact, and continued to roll, shearing off its solar array wings as it did. It rolled half a kilometer before coming to a stop against a natural rock abutment. Ben rose and immediately felt lightheaded, but drew on the Force to strengthen and stabilize himself. He helped Kiara up. "We have to hurry," he said. "More fighters may be coming." Ben told Kiara to climb a tree while he examined the wreckage. When he saw what was left of the pilot, a pale-skinned chief in a bronze uniform, he was glad he had. It didn't take him long to pry open the hatch into the starfighter's small cargo bay. Its contents had broken free of the cloth webbing that had restrained them, but were otherwise intact. 2 days' worth of rations for a grown man, a medical kit, power packs, a long-range comlink, a self-inflating raft, water purification tablets. He took it all, and scavenged other goods from the chief's body. Then, as fast as they could manage, he and Kiara ran from the site of the crash and back toward the dubious safety of the Citadel. It didn't occur to Ben to be sorry about the being whose life he had just taken. Coruscant, Errant Venture.
Ali Marar just calmed me.
Leia stared incredulously into her display, but Levent seemed earnest enough.
What did she want? You two, of course.
And what did you tell her?
I said you were going to be at Galadar 8 in a few days. The way I figure it, she'll go there and get herself blown to pieces. A shame about the YV-666, I guess.
Well, you didn't lie, Leia said. That's exactly where we're going to be.
We are, said Han.
You are?
On the display, Levent's jaws skewed to one side, an exaggerated expression of dismay.
I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Not to worry, Leia said. I didn't decide until just now. It's not enough to be told that someone like Ali Marar has been blown to bits. I really need to see it myself.
Or even pull the trigger, Han muttered.
Galadar System. Resort Station orbiting Galadar 8. From the distance of several hundred kilometers, Luke watched the activity at the station. He employed passive sensors only, including a holocam utilizing high-grade visual amplification hardware, and knew that Mara, floating less than 100 meters away in her own Stealth X, was doing the same. Half a dozen vehicles were docked at the station. The crews inside were presumably effecting repairs and making the antiquated station ready for the ceremony that would soon take place. Luke, Mara, and their fellow pilots, including Corrin, Kip, Jaina, and Zek, plus Jag, finally getting some shift time in Jaina's Stealth X, had scouted out the system pretty thoroughly. There were indeed droid sensor satellites along the standard approaches into the system, but none situated elsewhere, and there were routes to which the sensor array was blind from outside the system to the far side of Galadar 8. The Jedi had already led several ships from the Ninth Fleet to orbits within the outer atmosphere of Galadar 8. Another vessel they had guided into place was Admiral Neothel's temporary flagship, the aged but still mighty Mon Calamari cruiser Galactic Voyager. Luke shook his head over that choice. Was Neothel simply making use of an available resource? Or, recalling that the Voyager had once been the flagship of Admiral Ackbar, was she trading on the revered strategist's name to promote herself? Luke didn't know. But thinking about that was much better than wondering about Ben. Zeost. Ben and Kiara rested the remainder of the day, and from the top of the rock pile just inside the Citadel entrance, they watched the shuttle. It descended from the clouds less than 15 minutes after Ben, Kiara, and the revitalized Shaker reached the entrance. It was an old shuttle, with fold-up wings and a bronze paint job, and it did not land. It circled the crash site endlessly, then took off for the skies once more. Ben was curious about that. Were the crew members afraid to touch down on Zeost? That actually made sense. Hungry as they were, Ben insisted that they eat no more than half the rations they had scavenged from the TIE fighter. The rest they could eat over the next 3 or 4 days. Perhaps by then they'd be able to find more food, or find their way off-planet. They slept well that night, with Shaker keeping its sensors alert for nocturnal movement. But there was none. In the morning, glow rods attached to new power packs, they went searching. It didn't take long. All Ben had to do was open himself up to the voices. They led him down several levels, to where the corridor floors were coated in ancient muck, to a long side shaft that carried them well away from the Citadel proper. It led them to an unlit circular chamber. Its walls were decorated with 18 niches, each large enough to hold a life-sized statue of an average human, but all empty.
"It's gone,"
Kiara said. Ben shook his head. The images in his head were clear. The ship was here. "Come out," he said. He heard laughter. Kiara seemed to sense it too. She drew back to stand next to Shaker and stared all around, looking for the source. Ben frowned. His instincts, and what the voices had whispered to him when he only half understood their words, told him that emotion was the key. Nor would kind, soft, welcoming emotion do. He deepened his voice, put some anger into it.
"Come out!"
Had he tried it the day before, when he'd been at his weakest from lack of food, he doubtless would have failed. But now there was a rumble in the ground, and a crack appeared in the half-dried muck of the floor, a crack as straight as a laser beam bisecting the room. Shaker, whose legs straddled the crack, gave a tweedle of alarm and quickly moved to one side. Kiara joined him. The gap widened more quickly at the room's center than toward the edges. There it became circular, and up from it, inadequately illuminated by Ben's glow rod, came a segmented metal arm several meters long, and then the top portions of a vehicle's spherical main body. Its circular central viewport, lit from behind and glowing an unhealthy yellow, seemed to be an eye regarding them. The sphere was some 10 meters in diameter, half of it protruding above floor level. A gap of 3 meters separated the edge of the floor from the nearest portion of vehicle hull. Ben swayed, both from weakness and relief. The vehicle was here. It was real. And if the presence he felt within it, a malevolent set of emotions detectable through the force, was any indication, it was functional, even after centuries in the ground. "Open," he commanded. After a moment, a vertical line appeared beneath the viewport and lowered as a hatch, its near end just reaching the edge of the floor. Ben bounded across and up into the vehicle. But if he'd anticipated finding a control couch, a pilot's yoke, hyperspace, and weapons controls, he was disappointed. The interior, which could have occupied only a fraction of the vehicle's volume, was a single disc-shaped chamber, 4 meters across and 2.5 high. The corridor channel leading to the ramp was the only exit. The walls looked like orange pumice, glowing as though they were thin sheets over molten lava, and the vehicle's interior was very warm. When he got to the center of the disc-shaped chamber, Ben turned around and around, looking for the controls, but he found nothing. And now even the voices were gone. In their place was a powerful expectation, a sense of waiting. Ben closed his eyes and tried to get a sense of this place, this vehicle. And he did. For a moment he saw a red-skinned woman in robes of volcanic hues kneeling, her golden pole arm on the floor beside her. That was it, then. The pilot had to communicate with the vehicle through the force. Quickly, he knelt where the woman in his vision had been. "Command." The voice, male, rich in expectant malice, spoke directly into his mind. Ben looked down the ramp and beckoned for Kiara and Shaker. "Time to go." The little girl shook her head. The astromech tweedled at her. "Kiara, we have to leave."
"I don't want to go in that thing," she wailed. "It's going to eat me."
Ben shot her a reassuring grin.
"And if it does?"
She took a moment to answer.
"You'll jump down its throat, and we'll cut our way out together."
"That's right." Still reluctant, she came forward, tentatively took her first step onto the ramp, and ran up into the room. She flopped down to sit beside him. A moment later, Shaker rolled into place on his other side and locked its wheels. "Close," Ben commanded, and the ramp lifted. Now was the part he wasn't sure of. "Launch," he said. For long moments, nothing happened, and Ben wondered how many words he would have to go through before he found the correct command. But apparently intent was enough. Intent and visualizing what he wanted to happen. The light outside the vehicle brightened. Suddenly, blinding white, it reached all the way to the niches in the walls. Ben looked up, seeing only the ceiling above him. Then he closed his eyes again and attempted to see as the vehicle saw. And he did. The ceiling above the vehicle had drawn aside in two pieces, and sunlight shone down into the chamber. The vehicle began to tremble like a wild animal preparing to spring.
"Get ready," Ben said. "I think it's going to..."
The vessel accelerated straight upward, its movement pressing Ben and Kiara down onto the floor.